It's Thursday, November 1st, 2018, and we are five days away from the 2018 midterm elections. This is the Political Abstract Podcast, episode number 6. Welcome back to the conversation, and we have a lot to get to tonight. And I'm going to ask that you stick around till the end because I have some very poignant thoughts to offer on the terrible domestic act of terrorism, the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh this past weekend. But I'm going to hold that for the end, and we're going to start by looking ahead to next week and just give a quick update with where we're at with the election, current predictions, and what races we're looking at. So first, something good to always keep track of is President Trump's average approval rating. There's obviously a lot of polls. Some polls, like Rasmussen, tend to be more favorable for the president. Polls like Gallup, which only take adults and not registered or likely voters, tend to be a little bit lower. I stick to the averages. I think if you look at the averages and how they trend, you usually can't go wrong. Trump's current approval on the Real Clear Politics average is 43.9%. That's been about flat the last couple weeks. His approval actually increased a little bit after the Kavanaugh hearings and hasn't seemed to have dropped off at all with the recent controversies with his statements regarding illegal immigration or political violence, which we've experienced over the last couple weeks. That doesn't seem to have impacted the president's approval rating. And that's usually a good sign for the Republicans. Their fortunes tend to ebb and flow with the president's approval ratings in most, and that's true for most elections. The generic ballot is currently at Democrats plus 7.5. Again, that's the Real Clear Politics average. So I have seen there was a YouGov economist poll that was more favorable. Some of the more establishment polls, CNN, NBC, they tend to have a higher number, closer to double digits. But the average is right in the middle at 7.5, and that's exactly where it was a month ago. So what we've seen in the last 30 days is we've seen the Republicans gain a point, and we've seen the Democrats gain a point. And that's usually what happens as you get closer to the election within a month, is you have an undecided group of voters, and in most cases, they break 50-50 because the nature of undecided voters at this point is they're people that they're mostly independents. They're not particularly attached to one party or another. And these are really the true swing voters that go that don't vote with the same party more than half the time. So at this point, it's usually not realistic to expect them to break dramatically in one direction or another. There are some things which can change that, though. So to put this in perspective, remember a week before the 2016 presidential election, that's when the James Comey letter got announced that the Hillary Clinton email investigation was being reopened. And that was a bit of a turning point for President Trump. We saw him pick up momentum in the polls after that. A lot of people that were on the fence are going back and forth. I think at that point, they kind of resigned themselves that they just didn't want to hear about Clinton's email server again for another 4 years. And they decided that even if they weren't crazy with President Trump, they're ready to try something new. But even with that break, and it probably added about a point, maybe 2 points to President Trump's national vote total. Undecided voters, or voters who decided within a week, they broke 45 to 42% for President Trump in 2016. So he saw a surge, but as you could see, it was not dramatic. So at this point, if you're banking on undecided voters breaking dramatically towards the Republicans, that's probably not going to happen if history's a guide. There are some things that can change that. You can have a dramatic turn of events that can capture people's attention at the last minute. As we talked about last week, with these elections, it's not always about who has the best campaign season. Just like in sports, sometimes the team that's playing best going into the postseason is the one that will ultimately win the championship. That can be a lot of the case, too, in politics, where somebody can get hot and get momentum in the days leading up to the election. That momentum can continue exponentially when people go to the polls. We do see that happen quite a bit. So let's look at the narrative now and who may be having the narrative momentum. Clearly, there was a period of time where the Republicans experienced a bounce from the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, independent-leaning conservatives, traditional conservatives, Trump Republicans, everybody rallied together around Kavanaugh. And at the time, it certainly seemed like that was going to carry them to perhaps a surprising victory. But with the news cycle the way it is, nobody's talking about Brett Kavanaugh anymore. And that dynamic has shifted. So what are we talking about now? We're still talking about the recent spate of political violence. We had the mail bombs, which were sent out to about a dozen of them to Democratic officials and to media organizations. Of course, we had the horrible shooting in Pittsburgh this past weekend. And that's brought on the discussion of what culpability the media has versus President Trump. And it seems to be split about 50-50 in terms of public opinion, who's responsible for all the turmoil that's in our current environment. But people that are left on the fence at this point, again, there's no sense that they necessarily lean one way or another. So if this is the last thing that you're hearing going into the election, you see the president that you're not crazy about because you're not that attached to the Republican Party, you're not that attached to President Trump necessarily, and you see him once again after a moment of a national tragedy and an emergency with the mail bomb situation where that was going on over the course of a week, you see him once again, he doesn't strike a unifying tone, and maybe the drama of the Trump administration is starting to wear on you a little bit, and you say, you know what, now we're back to the theme of we just need to put a check on the president. And if you're kind of torn between your two candidates, maybe that factors into your decision. So I think if anything, that narrative might play into the advantage for the Democrats, maybe adding about a point to their national vote total. The other thing which is going on has been the reemergence of illegal immigration into the national conversation. And President Trump has tried his best throughout his presidency to keep us talking about illegal immigration. The problem is, and we talked about this last week, is when there's nothing in the news, it seems like the president is exploiting the issue. Well, he doesn't have to worry about that now because we have the caravan, which is making its way up through Mexico, still at least a month, probably even a little bit more away from reaching the U.S. border. But it certainly does provide some powerful visuals. The caravan did break down the gates at the Mexico-Guatemala border. There was a little bit of violent confrontation with Mexican authorities. So this is all playing into the president's hands and his desire to get people to focus on the issue of illegal immigration. Again, how much do these remaining voters care about illegal immigration? How much is it their top priority? We just don't know. I'm guessing that the people that are still on the fence are not particularly conservative, but you know, certainly from a narrative standpoint, it's worked to the president's advantage. It's allowed him to rally his base, the immigration hawks within the Republican Party, maybe some rural conservatives who were ambivalent about voting because they just tend not to be high propensity midterm voters. And he's been able to bring the issue back to the forefront with a very tangible example, something that comes along with very vivid imagery. So I think the caravan issue and the issue of illegal immigration in general is going to be good for the president for rallying Republicans. And maybe we're seeing a little bit of that. We highlighted a couple of Republican, solid Republican districts on the page earlier today, New Mexico 2nd and West Virginia 3rd, which had been competitive, not for any other reason than the fact that both of those races had really solid Democratic candidates who were well-funded and were doing a good job of keeping the race close. But we saw those races break towards the GOP by a few points and open up a little bit. New Mexico with a Republican candidate ahead by 5 points, the Republican candidate ahead by 7 in West Virginia 3. and maybe that's a leading indicator that the deep red territory will continue to break towards Republicans as this issue now is in the forefront and has become a bit of a rallying cry for Republicans. But I do think there's a price to pay for all this. And not because the president is talking about illegal immigration. I think it's the way he's going about it. And you know, let's be honest here. His rhetoric when it comes to illegal immigration, his strategy is to take very vivid anecdotal examples that are very powerful, and he tends to apply them to the broader issue of immigration coming up through Mexico. So in the case of the caravan, he's talking about criminals and murderers and rapists. And listen, when you have a group of 10,000 people, you're going to have some bad eggs in there. There's no question about it. It's probably not the bulk of these people. You know, statistically, again, we have to be honest here. Statistically, undocumented immigrants do not commit crimes or violent crimes at a higher rate than American citizens. That's just a fact. So if you're talking about illegal immigration, when you focus on the rare example of violent crime, the rare but potent and powerful and traumatic example of violent crime at the hands of illegal immigrants, I think to moderate voters, it comes across as scapegoating. So I think Trump's language, the way he's talking about the caravan, the way he talks about immigration in general, I think it's created an issue for him in the suburbs. And we've been talking about these suburbs, these Romney-Clinton suburbs that were held by GOP moderate Republicans, that Republicans would need to pick off some of them, or not pick off, but hold on to some of those seats with upsets in order to take back or to maintain the majority in the House. And we've seen some of those districts within the last week move towards the Democrats. We spoke earlier about New Jersey 7, which I thought was a really important one, because that's a good comparable prototype for similar districts. So if New Jersey 7, which is a Philadelphia suburb in western New Jersey, if that is now trending Democrat, if there are other affluent college-educated districts, New Jersey 7 is over half college-educated. I look to a district like Illinois 6, where Peter Roskam is a moderate Republican who's running for re-election. He's well-liked, just like Leonard Lance is, but he's running for re-election there in a district which Hillary Clinton won by 6 points. I suspect that the poll that we saw earlier this week with had him up by 2, I suspect that he's now down by more than 2, and you're probably seeing movement elsewhere. I would be very concerned about an affluent suburb like Texas 7, which is John Culberson running for re-election. That's a district which Hillary Clinton narrowly won, but previously Mitt Romney had done really well in 2012. Also, very college educated. Because these districts, they don't usually move in a vacuum. They usually move in accordance with similar demographic districts, and 538 has a great tool where you can see the similarity scores between districts. So if you look at one district, you can see which other ones might be moving with it. The other thing, of course, I would look at is New Jersey's third, which is in central New Jersey, and is a balance between being a Philadelphia suburb and being an Ocean County, which is heavily Republican along the Jersey Shore. I would be wondering if Tom MacArthur is in trouble there. That's another district that's not quite as highly educated, but still at least 30% plus college degrees. So that result, or that poll result in NJ7, that has me thinking that these affluent suburbs, where Republicans historically have had a lot of ancestral success there with moderate fiscal conservatives who were given the benefit of doubt in 2016, I don't think they're going to get the benefit of doubt this year. And I think a big part of it as we head into the home stretch here is going to be because of the inflammatory rhetoric. And again, it may be good for mobilizing the core Republican donors, but what I've been saying all along about these suburbs is even if they're not politically moderate, they're temperamentally moderate. So they're very concerned about civil unrest. They like safe leaders, people that are reassuring, not too risky. That's why you saw Mitt Romney do really well in a lot of these places, and then they push back against Donald Trump, because the perception is that Trump does use a lot of racially charged rhetoric, and he's unpredictable, and he doesn't have the same element of safety as someone like Mitt Romney did. And one other thing that we did talk about on the page earlier this week is I think in a lot of cases, the immigration policies that Trump is actually talking about, I'm not talking about the rhetoric, I'm talking about the actual policies of shoring up the border, putting physical barriers or wall, whatever you want to call them, in place where it makes sense, where Border Patrol says it's necessary, sending the National Guard or the Army down to provide backup if that's necessary, looking at the asylum laws, taking away the incentive for people to come in illegally, making it harder for them to come in illegally and stay here, ending catch and release. A lot of these things are things which I feel moderate voters respond to. They don't think they're racist policies. And my hypothesis is that voters don't necessarily care about the policy as much as they care about the intention. So with someone like Mitt Romney, who was a very big hawk on immigration, remember 2012, he ran on a no amnesty for anybody platform. He famously used the line of self-deportation, where if you took away the benefits of people that are here illegally, that they would self-deport themselves. Wasn't a great statement, wasn't a very realistic policy, but he was an immigration hawk. But people felt safe with Mitt Romney. They felt like he wasn't a racist. They felt like he didn't have ulterior motives. And they felt that if he did things, it was in the nature of the interest of protecting the country. And I think people, moderate, highly educated, affluent voters, I think they question President Trump's intention. We've seen polls where a lot of the country, whether it's 45% or half, whatever that number is, it's a high number, thinks that the president is a racist. Now, I don't think the president is a racist because he proposed to give legal status to 2 million DACA recipients, actually expanding the DACA program, which President Obama started. And people that are white nationalists don't do that. So he was willing to provide legal status to 2 million Dreamers in exchange for funding for the border wall. So I think when you look at the actual policies, what he's proposed, it's actually been a pretty conventional Republican policy. And it's just the inflammatory rhetoric is what concerns people, not the policy itself. So I think if he did a better job couching the message, talking about the benefits of legal immigration, and making it clear that we like immigrants, we want them to come here, we just want them to do it legally, I think he would be having more success in the suburbs because these are fiscally moderate places. Again, they're ancestrally Republican, and they've been so for a long time. A lot of them have very high costs of living. They're people that are doing well, so they're not over. They might not like the cost of healthcare, but they're probably not crazy about turning it over to a Medicare for All scheme. So these are places that could still be won by Republicans, but they're temperamentally moderate, and the tone and the tenor that the president has taken towards the issue of illegal immigration, I think, has really scared off a lot of these voters. And now you're seeing that as we're heading towards Election Day and entering the closing days, I think we're going to see more of those districts start to break towards the Democrats. But we may see Republicans in relatively safe territory that President Trump carried by 10 points or more in 2016. We may actually see Republicans improve their standing. So maybe this is a good strategy for stemming the tide. If you think that the House is done for, that Democrats are going to take over the majority, maybe this is a good strategy for strengthening up your core constituency and limiting Democrats' gain. If that's the case, if we're going into Election Day with a 7.5 point generic ballot, I think we're probably heading for a Democratic pickup somewhere in the mid-30s. Right now, my projection does call for a 28 to 38 seat pickup with a popular vote somewhere in the range of 7 to 9 points. I would say I'm pretty sure that we're going to tweak both those estimates a little bit higher, but we're probably going to go into Election Day, or I'm going to be going into Election Day expecting a pickup in the mid-30s. And anything higher than that would be a surprise. Anything significantly lower than that would be a surprise. As far as the possibility of Republicans retaining the House, last week we spoke, I put it at a 1 in 3 chance, or 30%. I think that's now 1 in 5 chance, and that might even be a little bit generous because really, I'm just not seeing the Republicans making gains in the places they would need to if they were going to have a legitimate shot at keeping the Democrats under a 23 net seat gain. Not just those races in New Jersey. There's also two in upstate New York. So Republicans may lose six seats alone in New Jersey and New York. Then we have Pennsylvania next door, and we're already halfway there towards that 23-seat net gain. So, and the other thing we haven't really talked about are the Orange County or districts in Southern California. We've been talking about those a lot, that Republicans were actually overperforming expectation there. Be really interesting if we get some new polls out of California to see how those races are breaking, and if the Republicans might be back on track to have some pretty severe losses in California. Remember, there were six districts that Hillary Clinton won in 2016 that are occupied by Republicans. So it's really hard to see how that plays out. The way it plays out is a systemic polling error, that if the polls are just weighting the expected turnout the wrong way, if Republicans are underrepresented. But I don't see that happening, because even in 2016, I know some of you are saying the polls were wrong. The polls said Hillary was going to win. Remember, nationwide and in the kinds of places we're talking about, the polls were accurate. They were not accurate in states with a high concentration of white working class voters with a low percentage of college education. The pollsters did not talk to enough of those voters, which is why the polls were off by so much in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio. But as a whole, the polls were okay. I really don't think the polls are off in these affluent suburbs, because you're talking about a college-educated electorate. Those are people more likely to answer pollsters' calls, I believe. They're certainly statistically more likely to vote in a midterm year. So I don't see it, but you can't rule it out if there's a systemic polling error. That would be the only way that the Republicans would hold on here, and I would put that as a 1 in 5 chance. And don't be shocked if I revise that downward next week. But now we're going to turn our attention to the Senate. And not a whole lot has changed. I just kind of want to reset the picture of where we're at. So on the Republican side, the Republicans have one seat, which would be an absolute stunner if they don't pick it up. And that, of course, is Heidi Heitkamp's seat in North Dakota. Latest poll out of there has Kevin Cramer up by 9. There's been other polls that have him up double digits. The Kavanaugh vote really seemed to end any chance Heidi Heitkamp had at holding on in North Dakota. So that's one seat that we can be pretty confident about. Now, on the Democratic side, their best chance to pick up seats is going to be in Arizona and Nevada. Arizona, the polls are dead even. There's a lot of mixed messages coming out of there for a lot of the reasons we've talked about. Arizona's tough to poll. It has one major metro area, Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix and the surrounding suburbs. 50 to 60% of the total vote is going to come out of Maricopa. So you have one population center and then a bunch of rural areas. So it's tough to get a read, which is why you're seeing these mixed messages from the polls. You'll see Sinema up by 5. Another poll came out, had Martha McSally up by 7. So I think that the wild card there is how strong the Latino vote turnout is in Arizona, and also how what the total vote is in Maricopa County. I really don't think that Martha McSally can afford to lose there by more than a couple points. And I now wonder, with the events of the last couple days and the trends we were talking about, if the upside is for Kristen Sinema there. And I've really been shocked that she's been able to hold on the way she has, especially after all that stuff came out about her past and her very radical liberal activism. Arizona still a very culturally conservative place. But I think what you're seeing is in the suburbs around Phoenix, and this is a place which has just exploded in population in the 21st century. So you have people coming in from all over the country that are moving there. And just suburbs in general, they tend to be more moderate. I think what you're seeing is I don't necessarily think that Kristen Sinema is the cup of tea for the average Arizona voter, but I think you're seeing a lot of people saying, listen, we just need to check on President Trump. You know, these are the affluent, college-educated voters that are pushing, especially women, that are pushing back against President Trump, and I think that's why Sinema really has not been hurt that much in the polls, even by all this news that makes her look a little bit more radical than advertised. I just think voters are in the mindset of they see a vote for McSally as a vote for Donald Trump. And remember, Donald Trump only won 47% of the vote in Maricopa County. 4 years prior, I believe Romney won 55. It was a big drop off. So there is a never Trump presence in Maricopa County. And even if Kristen Sinema is able to peel off 6% of the vote, those never Trumpers could be enough to throw the race to Kristen Sinema. So, you know, I just don't know. That one can go either way. But don't be shocked if Sinema pulls off or swings that seat. Nevada, Dean Heller is ahead in the averages by 2 points. There was another poll out just today that had his opponent, Jackie Rosen, who I believe is the current representative from Nevada's 3rd District, up by 3 points. So some mixed messages there as well. Heller's done a heck of a job hanging in there. Part of it is that he's a known commodity. He's an incumbent. He's pretty well established as a moderate voice. Who's willing to go back against Trump. Donald Trump has avoided the state of Nevada because it's believed that he would hurt them there. Remember, Hillary Clinton won the state of Nevada. But I know I sound like a broken record. You have to believe me when I'm talking about this turnout operation in Nevada and just how potent it is. And it's a lot of people that are not registered in the polls because they work overnights and you can only poll up to a certain time. And these unions, they make sure people get time off. They bus them to the poll sites. And a lot of people that don't show up in the polls end up actually going to vote. Hillary Clinton, I believe she overperformed her poll numbers in Nevada by 4 points. The best example in recent history was in 2010. Harry Reid was up against Sharron Angle, who was a darling of the Tea Party. And the polls actually had Angle ahead by mid-single digits, and it looked like she was going to knock off Harry Reid. It was going to be a big victory for Republicans, taking out the majority leader in the Senate, and Harry Reid ended up winning rather comfortably. I believe it was a 10 to 12 point swing, and Reid is still very active there in terms of maintaining that machine. So don't be shocked if we go into election night and it looks like Heller's a mild favorite. I believe he's a modest favorite according to 538. But don't be shocked if the turnout operation puts Jackie Rosen there over the edge. So two very real potential pickup possibilities in Nevada and Arizona for the Democrats. So then we look at some long shot possibilities for both parties. So for Democrats, neither of these things are going to happen. I will be totally stunned, but Democrats are looking at Texas and Tennessee. Both of the averages there are between 6.5 and 7 points. Ted Cruz has led wire to wire. It's much closer than it should be. Marsha Blackburn, she looked like she was in trouble for a while in Tennessee, and she's pulled ahead. But now there's some polls that have that race tightening up again, maybe to the mid-single digits. In Cruz's case, he's led the entire distance. Beto O'Rourke has never led a poll in Texas. And Marsha Blackburn is at or near 50% in the averages. So I think both of these candidates are going to hold on to their seats, but by very mild margins. And we've talked a lot about why that is. I think the Republican Party has a crisis of authenticity with these people that are heavily associated with the Tea Party era. And just kind of defaulting to the most conservative position possible that's convenient for appeasing the base or for fundraising purposes. And I think people that are not diehard conservatives are just tiring of the act a little bit. You know, Ted Cruz, we know he can be a bit grating as a personality. Marsha Blackburn's a little bit more likable, but she's seen as one of these automatic position people. You know, she is a professional Trump candidate. She's running on her association and her ties to President Trump, and that's enough to get the job done in Tennessee. But Republicans really should be cautious of these narrow victories, because even in a Democratic wave year, candidates should not be winning by 5 points in Texas or Tennessee. And I think moving forward, there's a template there for Democrats. If you get a young, enthusiastic candidate to run up against someone that's seen as either a tired establishment candidate or being a bit of a fraud, that's a recipe for success. The fact that they're going to get so close in Tennessee and Texas tells me this is something Democrats will definitely be looking at moving forward. For Republicans, I think they need to take a serious look at also getting candidates that, even if they're not less conservative, they're just less robotic. They seem more like real people. They're relatable, and maybe even a little bit more flexible on the issues. Because if you're an independent voter, the nature of being an independent voter is that you expect your representative to act in the best interest of your state, not to default to the best interest of their party. And I think in some of these red states, maybe, or at least with these very conservative Tea Party type candidates, that maybe the Republicans have been taking advantage of the independent vote for too long. And we'll see what kind of mentality they shift towards after Election Day. But I would definitely take that as a giant red flag. This is a bit of the canary in the coal mine. They're going to get lucky. They can survive in Texas and Tennessee just based on turnout alone and the affiliation with Donald Trump. But that's not going to cut it in a more competitive state. On the Republican side, the two long shot upset potentials are John Tester in Montana, who, even though he's only leading by 3 or 4 points, he's led wire to wire. I think he's going to hold on. And that's just a case of him being a really good retail candidate. This is a guy with a pretty liberal voting record for Montana, but he positions himself as being an independent voice in Washington, someone that is truly represents the true spirit of his state, is well connected to his electorate, and is just doing what's in the best interest of his constituency. He's branded himself really well, and I think that's why Republicans have had trouble overcoming John Tester in Montana, despite the fact that it was so heavily carried for Donald Trump, I believe, by 20 points. There may be a push. The Libertarian candidate has endorsed the Republican, Matt Rosendale, so we'll see if he gets any lift from that. I really don't think so. The assumption is that most people that vote for a Republican, Libertarians are Republicans, but it always tends to split 50-50 between cultural Libertarians and fiscal conservatives when it comes to Libertarians. So they tend to pull equally from both parties. So maybe he gains a point or so, but voters usually don't like being told who to vote for. So I wouldn't assume that whatever the share was of the Libertarian candidate, that's automatically going to go and put Rosendale over the edge. We saw that during the primary when John Kasich told his supporters to vote for Marco Rubio, and a pretty decent percentage of them still voted for Kasich. Voters don't like to be told who to go for vote for. They don't like the idea of playing games with the election. And then, of course, we have Bob Menendez in New Jersey, who incredibly is only ahead by 6.5 points in the polls, and the last couple have that maybe at around 5. And on a sheer turnout basis, there's no way that Bob Menendez should lose the election in New Jersey. What I can tell you the biggest threat is people going into the booth, leaving the Senate voting line blank, or just saying, you know what, I can't do it, can't vote for this guy. Remember, Menendez lost 40% of the primary vote to a candidate who didn't even spend any money. So even Democrats in New Jersey are fed up with this guy. And Bob Hugin has been a pretty decent candidate. He has some baggage of his own. He's a former pharmaceutical executive. And that's not necessarily a negative in Jersey. The pharmaceutical industry is a very big employer here. But his company was accused of some misleading practices on some cancer drugs. So that's been used as an attack against him. Also been attacked that the company raised the price of cancer medication and and may have worked to actively block cheaper from generics from coming onto the marketplace. But on the other hand, his company Celgene actually put a little over half of their revenue into research and development, which is above industry average. And the company's invented a lot of medications, which have saved a lot of lives. So that probably is not a huge negative. I don't think there's anyone that wouldn't vote for Bob Hugin or that would have voted for Bob Hugin that won't because of his background as a pharmaceutical executive. I don't think that's a thing. I think that's just a rallying cry for Democrats to make sure they go out and suck it up and vote for Menendez. But we'll just have to see. I would expect Hugin to do better than expected in Central Jersey. A big key for me will be looking into Northeast Jersey, Morris County area, places where Donald Trump fell off significantly from Mitt Romney's performance in 2012. So that's an area where there's not, if not never Trump Republicans, never Trump independents that usually vote Republican, and see if those people are inclined to suck it up and vote for Menendez because of their dislike for President Trump. Again, we know it's going to be a tough day on Tuesday for Republicans in New Jersey. So that'll be an interesting thing to look at, is these areas that are going to vote to throw their Republican representatives out of Congress, how do they respond to the Senate race? We'll just have to see. The other wild card is what happens in New Jersey's inner cities, Hudson County, Essex County. You're talking about Jersey City, Newark, places like that. Does the African-American vote show up for Bob Menendez? Does he have a problem getting him out? Because does he have a Hillary Clinton problem? Remember, Hillary Clinton struggled with African-American turnout around the country because she was seen as being corrupt and not offering much to the African-American community. But that was not the case in New Jersey. She actually improved on President Obama's vote totals from 2012. So we'll see. Jersey has a bit of a thick skin when it comes to corruption. Unfortunately, we're kind of used to it. So I wouldn't rule out that Menendez will win comfortably, but I also wouldn't be surprised if it was closer than expected. That's one of those things where I probably give Bob Hugin about a 10-15% chance of pulling off the upset. The three toss-up races where nobody knows what's going to happen for Republican, all Republican pickup opportunities are Missouri, Indiana, and Florida. And we've talked a lot about all three of these races. Missouri is a straight-up turnout operation. So President Trump is actually in Missouri tonight. He's going to be back there before Election Day. And that's all about getting out the rural vote in Missouri, because it's really about rural Missouri versus the St. Louis region, which obviously is heavily Democratic. And then the swing area is Kansas City. There's some polls that may have indication that Josh Hawley is performing better than Claire McCaskill in the Kansas City area. That's the region, the suburbs surrounding Kansas City. That's the region that's going to decide Missouri. That and Trump getting every Republican possible to show up from more rural, more conservative areas in Missouri. Indiana is so hard to tell. The polling's not great out of there because they have a lot of very strict laws. You're not allowed to use robocalls. You have to use live dialers, which limits the amount of data that we get out of Indiana. It looks like maybe Joe Donnelly is in pretty good shape there, but President Trump will be taking a trip to Indiana as well. So hoping to juice turnout there. He's actually going to be there twice before the election. We're going to get into Trump's travel schedule in just a minute. And then, of course, Florida looks like on paper that Senator Bill Nelson, the Democrat, is ahead by a couple points. But Florida has a history of being all over the place when it comes to polling. And that, too, will be a turnout game. How does the Hispanic and the African-American turnout compare versus the turnout in Florida's panhandle? President Trump is going to be making another trip to Florida before all is said and done. He was just there last night, I believe. So trying to juice the turnout there in the more conservative areas. And on election night in Florida, look to the Tampa region. Look for Rick Scott's performance in Hillsborough County, which went for Hillary Clinton very slightly, and Pinellas County, which is right next to Tampa. It borders the Gulf Coast. That actually swung from President Trump, President Obama to President Trump by about 30,000 votes. So the old story about Florida was that the entire I-4 corridor, which goes from Tampa to Orlando, was swing country. But in all reality, most of the true swing voters that are left that go back and forth between the parties are in the Tampa region. And whoever wins Pinellas and Hillsborough usually ends up winning the state. So look there in central West Florida along the coast if you want to get an idea for how that state's going. But that's going to be a fascinating race to watch. I think we're going to be up all night counting votes in Missouri and Florida. Indiana is a bit of a wild card, like I said. I think Joe Donnelly might be in good shape to hang on there. Indiana's kind of a weird, counterintuitive state where their pro-Trump support may not matter as much as you would think, but we will find out in short order. And I did want to touch real quick on the president's travel schedule, because this is really important, and stick with me on this. This shows where the priority is, or the strategic priority is, where Republicans think that Trump's presence can help. So tonight he's in Columbia, Missouri. Tomorrow he will be in Huntington, West Virginia. The West Virginia one's a little bit weird. There's been some polls out of there that have showed that that race may be tightening up. I don't quite buy it. I don't think Joe Manchin's in trouble there. But the president's going to be making a trip there, and that's a state he won by 40 points. So maybe he feels like his overwhelming popularity will be enough. Joe Manchin is one heck of a politician, and I think he's going to be okay there. Very savvy vote on his part to vote for Brett Kavanaugh to enhance his bipartisan credentials. Then the president will be in Indianapolis, Indiana, of course, trying to do what he can to put Mike Braun, the Republican challenger in Indiana, over the top. Then he will go to Montana. This is an interesting one. I suspect Trump probably thinks that the Republicans should win in Montana. He may have a bit of a personal vendetta there because John Tester did sink Trump's Veterans Affairs nominee earlier this year. I'm not sure about that. I don't know if that's a great trip, but it's a chance to pick something up. It's only 3 points, and he's going to a rural part of Montana to try to make sure that all the rural vote gets out. But we'll see what happens there. The same day, on the 3rd, he'll be in Pensacola, Florida. That's in the Panhandle. Again, very critical region. Not necessarily the most people in Florida, but the Panhandle is culturally more similar to Alabama and Mississippi than it is to Central or Southern Florida. So it tends to lean very conservative, a lot of evangelical Christians, things like that. And this is all about trying to juice turnout in the Republican strongest part of the state. Smart play there by Trump going there as opposed to going to a swing region where maybe voters are more inclined to vote anyway. On the 4th, he'll be in Macon, Georgia. This one is a little bit interesting. The only reason he's going to Georgia is to try to get the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Matt Kemp, over the top. He's the Secretary of State in Georgia. He's running against Stacey Abrams, who's attempting to become Georgia's first female black governor. And I think this is important on a couple levels. Give President Trump credit for this. When somebody supports him, he tends to repay the favor politically. So Kemp was a full-throated supporter of Donald Trump. Even though Georgia's been swinging or drifting towards more of a purplish state, Kemp has been full-throated in his affiliation and his endorsement of President Trump. So Trump will return there to return the favor. But also, this could have 2020 implications because Stacey Abrams is running a campaign. It seems stereotypical to say that a black candidate is running on getting out the black vote. But in her case, she's been very overt about this, that she's trying to go into the inner cities and get Georgia's pretty sizable African-American population out to vote. And remember, African-Americans are typically not high propensity midterm voters. So her strategy is based on getting out all the low propensity voters from Atlanta's cities. And Kemp then is trying to rally the traditionally conservative parts of the state and then the battleground will be in the suburbs. So if Stacey Abrams gets elected, then she's activated all these African-American voters from the city, and then she'll have a machine in place in 2 years for 2020 to get out the vote against President Trump. So this could be an important race for 2020, because who holds the governor's mansion will then have their machine in place, all their contacts at the county and state and city level looking to pay a favor and get out the vote for the governor. So that could be really important for 2020, as Georgia is a major pickup opportunity. And then just closing out the list here, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Cleveland, Ohio. That has more to do with the governor's race. I don't think that the Senate race is really in play in Ohio. Then on the 5th, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he'll close out back in Missouri again, where he'll end the campaign. So you can see that Missouri, Indiana, obviously high priority, right along with Florida, and the president will take a stopover in Ohio. I wish he had made a play for Michigan. You know, you just never know with Michigan. Bernie Sanders shocked the world there against expectations of the polls and the primary. Donald Trump did the same in the general. Has a history of polling misses. I wish that Trump would have gone to Upper Michigan and tried to rally the vote there to see if John James, who's an up-and-coming star in the Republican Party, could make it close, if not pull off the major upset there. But it seems like he's down by double digits. That would have been worth taking a shot at after. There are some vanity plays in here, some window dressing. Trump's going to go to Tennessee. He wants to take credit for Marsha Blackburn's victory. But in reality, she was probably coasting for victory there anyway. And he wants to be the one to take credit for possibly pushing Josh Hawley over the head in Missouri and Rick Scott in Florida. So this is a pretty smart conservative travel schedule. He's not taking any chances, but I think there may be a couple races where maybe it would have been worth trying to take a trip. But for everybody that likes to rip Trump for his executive time and the amount of TV that watches, this is a heck of a travel schedule here. So President Trump is not holding anything back when it comes to trying to shore up the Senate. And I still hold my prediction right now, Republicans heading for a 1-4 seat gain. You could see a situation where Democrats could gain 2 and Republicans could gain 1, and it would be 50-50 with Pence holding the tiebreaker. You could also see things go the other direction and Republicans could end up with as many as 55 seats or 56 seats. So there still is a wide range, but I think it'll be somewhere 1-4, probably 1 or 2 seat gain. But I'll have final predictions next week before the election. And as we close out here, I did want to add some final thoughts about the horrible shooting. Really, domestic act or terrorism is all anything you could call, only thing you can call it, at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh this weekend. And I want to add a little bit of a personal touch to it, and just explain to everybody, if you don't know. And again, I'm not a religious person, but I've been exposed to this stuff for most of my life, so I have a bit of a perspective here to offer. Just about why this is so traumatic to not just anyone that's a religious Jew, but just anybody that's culturally Jewish or has a Jewish heritage. And it's because anti-Semitism is really a very specific type of sick evil. And it's rooted in the belief that Jews are responsible for all of the evil and injustice in the world. And, really goes back to biblical times. Again, I'm kind of talking out of my pay grade here, but Jesus did not allow his followers to charge interest on their debt, on their loan. Jews were allowed to do this under Jewish law. So that's when Jews developed the reputation or the stereotype of being greedy and controlling the money, because they were the only ones that were allowed to make loans. This goes back to biblical times. And really, ever since then, Jews have been the scapegoat. And in many ways, and that's why you hear all these ridiculous stereotypes about Jews controlling the media, and they control entertainment, and they control Hollywood. And I've even heard that Jews control the weather. I'm not quite sure how that works. But that's where all this stuff comes from, that Jews are responsible for all the evil, and they control all the money, and they do it at the expense of other people. And these are stereotypes which go back thousands of years. And they never really go away because they're so embedded in the people that believe them. So I'm not trying to make light of any other type of prejudice at all. Any type of hatred, any type of prejudice is inherently evil. And we should universally condemn that as a society. But when you look at, say, the prejudice against African Americans, it's based in the belief of whites having generic superiority. Well, that gets disproved every day. Remember, if you go back into the early 20th century, blacks weren't even allowed to play basketball. Can you imagine that? And gradually, we figure it out as a society that, you know, blacks are pretty darn good athletes, a lot of them. And as you see, African Americans succeed in all walks of life, in the political realm, President Obama, of course, being the first black president, people like Tim Scott in South Carolina, it becomes obvious that there is no genetic superiority for a race. And the number of people that can credibly claim to believe it, it just gets smaller and smaller by the day. I know racism is out there. I know hatred and ignorance is out there, but it really is marginalized on the outskirts of society. The problem with anti-Semitism, and if you want to extend another example, a lot of the nationalist racism against Hispanics is the belief that European culture is inherently superior and people are threatened by cultures coming from Central and Southern America, that they believe that it's inherently bad because it's not based in European, which, you know, that goes back to the whole blood and soil theory of white nationalism. And that's obviously not true to anyone that has any modicum of common sense. But when you look at anti-Semitism and it's just based on a generalization of greed and manipulation, that's a really hard thing to kind of get out of the system. So that's why anti-Semitism is still around. It's why it'll probably always be around, because there are people that will always believe that they're getting screwed by the Jews. And that's why it's very important that everybody universally condemn anti-Semitism and all forms of hate, because we must try to marginalize it to the outskirts of society and make it clear that people that believe this are not part of the mainstream conversation. And that's why I'm so glad to see what the National Republican Senate Congressional Committee did by distancing themselves and condemning Steve King for associating with a white nationalist. That kind of stuff is really important. But the other thing I want to add is that in many ways, the Jewish people were the first victims of identity politics. You know, there were people that were having hard times, and they were told that these other people are responsible for all your problems. And that's why identity politics, whether you're talking about Jews, or you're talking about banks, or you're talking about the wealthy, or you're talking about immigrants, is so evil. Because it's so easy to take people that are having a hard time and convince them that it's someone else's fault. And that's why we must reject all forms of identity politics, not just on the left, but on the right as well. Because it's very easy for them to turn ugly quickly and have lots of unintended consequences. But on the other side of that, if you are the victim of identity politics, as many people and many races and many ethnicities have been when they've come to this country, not just Jews, but Russians and Italians and Germans and Irish and countless others, and of course African Americans, and now people coming from Mexico and from Central America, that it's important to keep your head down and to not allow the bigots to make you a victim. And this is why I think that politics of victimization are so dangerous, not just for the people that are creating victims, but the people that are being victimized. If you allow yourself to be seen as a victim, if you think of yourself as a victim, that's the quickest way to make sure that you don't get ahead. And what I'll say is about this, the lesson of Jews in America, and as horrible as this incident was in Pittsburgh, America has been a safe haven and a refuge for Jews. And it's never more so true than it is today. This is the safest country that there's ever been for Jews, and it is the greatest country on earth because a lot of ethnicities and a lot of nationalities and a lot of races can say that same thing, that this place has been a refuge from violence and hatred and intolerance and systemic persecution. But what I will say, because the Jewish story is the only one I can relate to personally, is that if the Jews allowed themselves to become victims or to think of themselves as victims, they would never have made it. The reason why Jewish people were able to succeed and overcome the persecution, and you know, I have family that came here into Brooklyn, New York, which has always been the melting pot of America. So that means that the cultural tide was constantly shifting, and anytime there's a shift in cultural or ethnic makeup, a lot of resentment comes from people that are displaced. And you know, I've heard stories from family members where you would walk through the streets and you would see signs to say no dogs or Jews. So this is very real, and this is not 200 years ago. This is, you know, early 20th century. And what I'm saying is that if Jews had allowed themselves to get trapped in that sense of victimization, they would never have made it. But the story of the Jewish people in America is that they kept their head down, they focused on working hard, and they focused on getting an education and getting ahead. And even though there still is anti-Semitism in this country and in the world, there always will be, because there always will be a percentage of people that give in to the temptation of hate and blame. Jews have gone on to become very productive parts of the American fabric in a lot of different industries. And that's why there's a lot of resentment, because they've been successful. But even as they've been successful, they've disproven a lot of the stereotypes by giving back to society. So while anti-Semitism is still there, it's constantly being pushed back by the truth and by good people seeing that these awful stereotypes are not true. And I want to close by saying just that, that in this day of identity politics and victim politics, I would say you really want to stick it to the bigots. You want to prove them wrong. You want to marginalize them. Just keep your head down and you succeed. Because if you do that, that's how you kill hate, is you prove the hate wrong. And you don't allow an intolerant asshole to make you feel like a victim. Because at the end of the day in this country, and I know this is a controversial statement, anyone under any set of circumstances can improve their situation. It may not be easy, it may not be fair, it may not always be right, but if they have the will to the desire to keep their head down and work hard to get ahead, anybody can make it in America. And that's why this is the greatest country on earth, and I will never apologize for saying that. Thanks for sticking with me. I hope it was worth your time. If you enjoyed us, please share it with your friends. Rate us on your podcast app of choice. And make sure to head over to Facebook, look us up. We are The Political Abstract, and we are editorially conservative and very honest about that. But we work hard to present you with fair facts. And our goal here at The Political Abstract, our mission, is to facilitate intelligent discussion and debate with people across the political spectrum, and we hope we're doing just that. So enjoy your weekend. Everyone, make sure you figure out how you're going to get to your polling location, whether you have to take off from work or go in late. Figure out how you're going to get there, because the most important thing that you can do is show up and vote. And then if you do that, then you have a right to complain or to enjoy the victory. But make sure you get out there and vote on Tuesday, and I'm sure I'll talk to you before then. Have a great night, great weekend. Take care.